All right, cheers, man. Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 7th of July, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, Patrick Henningsen. And Patrick, we're going to start off with a fantastic story. The headline here is 350 diplomatic flights carry weapons for terrorists.
Yes, this story is published by the Trude newspaper. This is based in Sofia, Bulgaria, and to help us get through this story, and we're going to talk to the journalist who broke it. Diliana Gitiniera is joining us on the live link from Sofia, and essentially, we'll talk to her in a second. What this is about 350 charter flights from Silkway Airlines. This is based in Azerbaijan, and these are trafficking weapons internationally and using diplomatic charters in order to sort of conceal the business of these flights. And this goes everywhere, including Syria. But it's not limited to that. We're talking about Africa, Afghanistan. We're also talking about the Congo. So weapons.
Let's put this into a little bit of context, Patrick. Here's a map showing where some of these weapons are going.
So as you can see, we're talking mainly about Baku in Azerbaijan being the hub of this international weapons trafficking operation, and we're also going to say that this is primarily NATO member states, and the airline in question, this charter airline Silkway, they have a record of doing NATO charter flights. In fact, we'll talk about this a little bit later, but yeah, one of their planes crashed at Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan a few years ago, and that was a big incident. Basically, but doing business, basically doing work for NATO.
Right.
So let's bring in our guest, Diliana Gitiniera. She's an investigative journalist, 15 years an investigative journalist and a Middle East correspondent. She's worked on Libya and also in Syria, and she's joining us on a live link from Sofia, Bulgaria. Thank you for joining us, Diliana.
Thank you for having me.
And so this is a pretty tremendous story, Diliana, and we first saw your previous report, which you broke, and it got syndicated by a few big news outlets previously about the Bulgarian weapons cache, which you discovered when the liberation of East Aleppo back in December 2016. You were there in Aleppo, and you found these weapons and traced this shipment back to your home country, Bulgaria. So just let's introduce this story a little bit. Tell us how this started.
Yeah, right. In December of last year, I was reporting on the Battle of Aleppo when the jihadists, or to be precise, al-Nusra Front, al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria, retreated from their positions. I was able to get inside those nine underground warehouses full of heavy weapons with the country of origin, Bulgaria. So I filmed those weapons, and this was the proof that Eastern European weapons are supplied to terrorists in Syria. The Bulgarian government denied all those allegations, and their response was that those weapons were bought by another country. So it wasn't a direct shipment to the terrorists. With my last article, actually, I disclose the way in which those weapon supplies end up in the hands of the terrorists, not only in Syria, but also in Yemen, in Congo, in Pakistan, wherever you can think of. The dimensions and the gravity of those weapon supplies on diplomatic flights, they're tremendous and they're shocking for me as a journalist, as a Bulgarian, I can't accept that this could be possible to be carried out by a state-run company. In this case, this is the Azerbaijan's Silkway Airlines. And Azerbaijan as a state is involved because the scheme is, I will explain, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Azerbaijan sends instructions to the embassies of Azerbaijan in Europe, in Asia, in Africa as well, to request diplomatic clearance. In fact, Silkway Airlines, they are civil aircraft, so they are not allowed to carry on board dangerous goods. In this case, we are talking about weapons, heavy weapons. So they use this loophole in the law and in the international regulations, which allow them to get permission or exemption from transportation of dangerous goods. And it is granted by the local authorities. This is how the scheme has worked for at least 3 years. I have documents for 350 diplomatic flights with heavy weapons, and I have the proof, and I saw this myself on the ground in Syria, that the very same weapons end up with the jihadists in Syria, not only in Syria.
And I might add that you also identified some of these Bulgarian weapons in ISIS propaganda videos, which are available as well online. So you confirmed that some of these weapons have made it into the hands of ISIS as well, right?
Yes, this information, it is provable. It is easily verifiable. Those films and footage posted online on the official propaganda channels of the Islamic State, they prove that Bulgarian weapons and Eastern European weapons are used by the terrorists.
Mm-hmm. And also, the other thing that was interesting, the 122-millimeter Grad rockets. And these are the same Grad rockets that the so-called moderate rebels are shelling civilian areas in West Aleppo, or in Aleppo right now. Even today, they're still taking some Grad rockets as well from outside, from the so-called rebels. These are the same weapons, right?
It's shocking how they call them moderate rebels. How can rebels be moderate when they are heavily armed, when they kill civilians? Because I saw myself, one of those Grad rockets fell next to us in Western Aleppo and killed and beheaded a mother and her child in front of me. I saw them dying and before my eyes by the very same rockets fired by the so-called moderate rebels in Aleppo. Those were not moderate rebels, those were Al-Qaeda affiliates. And I traced those rockets, and according to the documents which I obtained from the Azerbaijan's embassy to Bulgaria, those rockets were transported on diplomatic flights. And what is important to say, how the scheme works, the airplane lands and makes a technical landing on intermediary locations, for example, let's say Turkey, in Adana or in Jilik military air base, which is located just 200 kilometers away from the border with Syria. According to documents, the very same weapons should have been obtained and received by the Ministry of Defense of Azerbaijan. But those rockets and those heavy weapons never reached Azerbaijan and the Ministry of Defense of Azerbaijan. Those rockets reached terrorists. And I saw what I'm talking now personal experience. I'm not talking unverifiable facts.
So basically, the Azeri government requested diplomatic clearance, and so embassies were sent notes to the ministries of these host countries. And they just happen to be mostly, we're talking about NATO member states or friendly NATO allied states as well. And so from Azerbaijan, from Baku, we have this network. So we have flights going to the Czech Republic. We have Slovenia or Slovakia, I think Slovakia, Serbia as well, and Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, North Sudan, Burkina Faso, the week before a coup took place, by the way, we might add. This is all detailed in Diliana's article, Mike. And also, in terms of the U.S., you've also uncovered $1 billion, if you total up the weapons transfers from with the United States, a total of $1 billion in weapons transfers. This is quite a substantial cachet of weapons. What other countries besides the U.S. are involved in this? What Western countries did you see? I think Sweden was mentioned as well, possibly Norway. Explain who's involved.
It's shocking how many countries around the world are involved. Many European countries, as you mentioned, NATO members from Europe, the United States, U.S. Special Operations Command, and other customers of this service, diplomatic flights for weapons, which are, by the way, exempt from checks, inspections, and air bills. Other customers of those diplomatic flights are Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. By the way, talking about the main customers of those flights, definitely these are the United States and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is indicated as the sponsoring party in many of the documents for the transportation of those weapons. So, for example, one private company from the US or from Bulgaria or from Serbia or wherever buys weapons. Actually, the real and the sponsor of this purchase is not the Balkan state or the private company. It is Saudi Arabia. This is indicated in the documents. Interestingly, some of the payments were made in cash in American dollars. So how can we talk about legal supplies when you pay cash, not in the way that is supposed to do it? And for me, what is shocking is that actually this scheme, it is legal, but it is used for illegal supplies of weapons. And I thought, how can this be possible? But it is possible because using the loopholes in the international regulations, in IATA regulations, all these suppliers, all these services from around the world can supply freely their weapons we see the result in Syria. More than 500,000 people have already been killed by the president.
Let's take a look at some of the front companies involved in procuring this. We've got, in her article, she talks about the Purple Shovel, is an American front company that was used in the train and equip program in Syria. And this is Coleman International, LLC. They work with the Department of Defense in the United States. They're based, I believe, in Alexandria, Virginia, just a stone's throw away from the CIA. And so they're clearly involved in this. Their name was on one of the procurement documents in Diliana's investigation. Also, Chemring, and they're based in Florida. And so these are the companies that are basically doing the work, doing the supplying. And so this is a way of outsourcing to corporate partners, or what seems to be, they're functioning like CIA front companies, you could say. And so this is a way of basically waging illegal war, but without breaking the law, technically. This is what the outsourcing is doing here. And this is all detailed in her investigation on Trude newspaper. The detail is amazing, Diliana, and hopefully we'll get you possibly on the Sunday Wire on Sunday to maybe go into a more of an in-depth analysis on this. But we want to point people to your investigation on Trude, which we'll hopefully link to after the show on Twitter. But thank you so much for your work on this story, and we'll be hopefully contacting you for more updates on this. There she goes, Diliana Gitiniera from Sofia, Bulgaria.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you. Right, let's move straight on then to the G20. And of course, Donald Trump meeting, well, he did meet Vladimir Putin just briefly this morning. And they are going to meet later for more in-depth discussions in Hamburg. In the lead up to this, Rex Tillerson was saying we're at the beginning. And I would say at this point, it's difficult to say exactly what Russia's intentions are in this relationship. And I think that's the most important part of this meeting, to have a good exchange between President Trump and President Putin over what they both see as the nature of the relationship between our two countries. But if you look through the mainstream media today, Patrick, just huge angst amongst the media. What might happen? Could they actually get along? It would be terrible if they did. BBC not terribly happy at that prospect, and so they're constantly downplaying it. If we look at what's going on outside the G20, thanks to RT for this, as we suggested earlier in the week, we predicted that there was going to be trouble. And if you remember, we mentioned that the Hamburg police absolutely confused as to why this event was being held in the center of the city, because this was the inevitable consequence of it. But the key point here is Trump and Putin and the fact that they don't want these two guys to get along. So lots of diversionary stuff going on, Patrick. And in Georgia, we have this report coming out a couple of days ago, just in time for the G20 meeting. What are they saying? They're saying that Russia has moved the border between Russia and Georgia, the South Ossetian border.
That's what they're saying.
That's what they're saying.
But is that what actually happened?
Well, nobody, who knows? These green signs apparently have appeared, and apparently they have appeared several hundred meters on the Georgian side of the border.
100 meters inside the Georgian side.
Well, various different reports, between 100 meters and 700 meters is what we're being told here.
Okay.
And so is this an attempt to reinflame the South Ossetian conflict in time for this meeting with Trump? It could well be.
It looks like a media event. Absolutely. Here you can see the press have all sort of congregated here at this place here in South Ossetia.
Absolutely. So the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Georgia expressed, quotes, its deep concern over the illegal installation of a so-called border sign across the occupation line. They said that they're going to use all levers at their disposal to let the Russians get away with it, those dirty Russians doing this kind of thing.
So this is a handy talking point which made its way, I think, on the BBC this morning, or was it
mentioned?
It
was absolutely
news?
Mentioned on BBC Radio 4 this
Russia's
morning.
Russia's moved the border of Georgia, basically. That's the talking point. And so demonization of Putin, and in terms of Trump and Putin in the same meeting, it's like moths to a flame for the Antifa and all the various controlled opposition street
absolutely.
Operatives and things like that.
And so, let's not forget that we've just come out of a whole week of conferences held by various people in the UK on Ukraine. Boris here in his opening comments saying Ukraine, I think it's in the etymology, it stands literally on the frontier of the challenge by Russia to the rules-based international system in which we all believe and in which the UK is determined to preserve. So... what do we make of this?
So is part of the rules-based international system that Boris Johnson is referring to there, does that include 500 tons of military weaponry for terrorists, which we covered in the first segment today?
Yeah.
Is that part of the rules-based international system? I might ask that question.
David, what are your thoughts? Is that what the rules-based international system represents?
I can tell you exactly what the rules-based international system represents. George Herbert Walker Bush explained it. He said the New World Order is coming, and this represents a situation where the rule of law, not the law of the jungle, will govern international politics. So rules-based international order is New World Order, is central control of the whole globe, by people that you cannot see and cannot get rid of. And it would appear that both Trump and Putin are not playing by that game and are somewhat off reservation.
Indeed. But let's look at another clip from RT from the G20. And this is something you sent me earlier. David, thank you for this. Ken Livingston's comments. Let's just listen to this and we'll comment on them.
Okay, let's focus on the meeting itself. What's going on behind those doors? How tricky is it going to be to get the G20 leaders even on the same page here? Chancellor Merkel laid into the US for not being cooperative. There are rifts between the US and China, rifts between Turkey and the EU. Wow. Is it going to be, I'd love to be a fly on the wall of that place. How difficult is it going to be to get everyone singing off the same page? Or is that not the point? Is the point just to get everyone talking?
Well, what I found interesting here, you've got mayors from all around the world. There's a huge consensus and agreement. Mayors are doing things to tackle the problems of climate change. Most governments are slow to react. I'm almost beginning to think it's time to abolish governments and just let the world be run by large cities. If you're a mayor, you're living in your city, you're aware of its problems, you know you need to tackle them. Too many presidents and prime ministers live in a sort of academic world where they're debating ideas and theories and very often get caught up in wars that are completely unnecessary, like in Iraq and in Libya.
Because David, city-states in the past never had wars, did they?
They didn't, and apparently being ruled by a mayor is somehow different from government. We're going to abolish government and replace it with government. But in the meantime, your nation has gone. I wonder how that will work out well for liberty.
So there's the city-state.
The world.
There's the city-state agenda. Global Parliament of Mayors, which we've spoken about many times on this program, and Ken Livingston is right there on cue to sort of deliver the agenda right there, the agenda for the agenda 21.
Absolutely,
as it were. Yeah.
David.
Yes, and where is Red Ken getting this from? Because he did not think that up. He's not gone in for a cup of coffee with other mayors and, it's all going very well, let's abolish government. No, that particular agenda, is Agenda 21. This is something that's been very carefully worked out, and he has decided to go along with this for his own political purposes. And he is not being in any way honest about why or what we're giving up or what he's suggesting. I thought it was really a very striking little piece of propaganda.
Absolutely. Well, let's move straight on to Syria then. And this report for the European Council on Foreign Affairs, European Council on Foreign Relations, and this is Crispin Blunt, who is the chairman of the Defence, the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, who's that on the right there, Patrick?
That looks like our local MP, Johnny Mercer.
It is indeed. It's our local MP, Johnny Mercer, and they have written this joint article, how Britain should respond to chemical weapons attacks in Syria. It's a policy brief for the European Council on Foreign Relations. Now, European Council on Foreign Relations, they describe themselves as an award-winning international think tank. They're not related to the Council on Foreign Relations, but they are funded by the Open Society Foundation, amongst other foundations, right? So let's put that in a bit of context. And what are these guys saying? They're saying deterring the use of chemical weapons is a clear priority for the international community. However, despite various deterrence strategies over the years, international institutions are failing to manage the problem. In any request to the UK to offer practical support to the US and or France in response to another chemical attack in Syria, the UK government must address questions regarding the threshold for military action, the intelligence designating responsibility for chemical attacks, the legality and limitations of proposed action, and how an intervention would fit into the UK's wider policy resolving the conflict in Syria. Passing a preemptive motion would allow the UK to move swiftly in the event of another attack, and the motion itself, especially if coordinated with positions of the US and France or other European partners, could act as a deterrent in and of itself. But this is, Patrick, absolutely unprecedented, where at least one senior MP and one relatively junior MP, but both ex-military men themselves, one the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, are calling for what's effectively an enabling act, whereby the government would not need to seek permission to go to war for each individual action. They would simply be given a blanket permission to do whatever the heck they liked if in the event of any contrived event.
This is an end run around the democratic process. So what they're trying to do is implement a United States style authorization of the use of military force, which is sort of permanently on the table and enables you to basically to go where you want, do what you want, whenever you want, without having to go and sort of debate or vote for it. In the case of the chemical weapons issue in Syria, all of the sort of previous claims by this government and by the United States that the Syrian government has been using chemical weapons against its own people are completely based on disinformation, fabricated evidence, and in most cases, no evidence whatsoever. Some of the details of this are outlined by Professor Tim Hayward on an article that's up on 21st Century Wire right now. I encourage people to go read that. But there is no evidence of Assad gassing his own people or using sarin against his own people. It's completely hyperbole based, and a lot of it's just kind of media spin. But there's absolutely no evidence to suggest other than doctored evidence by the so-called rebels or by El Nusra Front in the case of Khan Shaun in April. So there is nothing.
David, how many times do we have to hear rhetoric like the intelligence designating responsibility for X, Y, or Z? How many times are we going to be fooled by bogus intelligence? Have we still not learned the lessons of 2003?
Well, I think we may have, because this is why this egregious little idea has come forward, because what it's saying is, well, we can't actually get a vote through Parliament when we're looking at actual evidence of a gas attack, because the evidence is, rubbish. So what we'll do is we'll not look at the evidence, we'll look at a hypothetical case. And the hypothetical case is, the hypothetical evidence is much more convincing. And we'll convince Parliament to vote for this based on purely imaginary set of circumstances. And then we'll reinterpret the reality to match that whenever we want. And away we go. It does strike me that it's an admission that they can't actually substantiate their case on Syria anymore. But it also strikes me that if that ever became law, the British Constitution would be dead.
Absolutely. Right. It is the anniversary of the July 7th attacks in 2005. Tony Blair said at the time, or just afterwards, Patrick, no need for an inquiry.
I remember it vividly. He said, no need. We need to move on. The country needs to move on. There's been enough suffering. And so if we don't need an investigation or an inquiry or anything into what happened on 7/7, that was Tony Blair, Prime Minister at the time. Here we are 12 years on from July 7th, 2005.
For some reason, the BBC carried an interview with John Chilcot yesterday. And we have a website here called The Road to Somewhere Else, and an article called Chilcot Revisited by Daniel Margrian. And this is commenting, is it, on the BBC and Chilcot's comments to the BBC?
This is absolutely great piece here by Danny Margrian, basically breaking down the hypocrisy of the of Chilcot's comments, but also of the Chilcot inquiry itself, and really showing that a completely remorseless Tony Blair, but then sort of apologists on the Chilcot side after how many 10 million pounds and everyone's taken millions in fees who has worked on this so-called investigation. And they've completely let Blair off the hook. At no point does it say definitively that they basically, fabricated or they built the intelligence, sexed up the intelligence around a predetermined policy to attack Iraq, which is totally provable.
But some of Chilcot's comments were just nutty, emotional truth.
They were, Tony Blair showed something to do with, exhibited emotional truth. And he never strayed, or he never abandoned the truth, or I don't know.
Yeah, he did say that.
There's some incredible comments in there. You can read them in the article by Danny Magrain there, but yeah. It was pretty shocking. So why is this happening now? Why are they resurrecting the Chilcot talking point at this particular time?
That's a good question.
And I think it's very much connected with the Crispin Blunt also and Johnny Mercer's push to get Parliament to approve an authorization of military force against Syria as well.
Yeah. Of course, in the meantime, the United Nations and the United States are dying to get directly involved in Syria. They're pretty much being held out of the situation at the moment because of threats from Russia and so on over downed Syrian aircraft. So here we've got the UN Special Envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, commenting on the the fact he believes that Astana, the Astana peace process, and the Geneva peace process are compatible. They're basically should be brought together in some way. He said Astana is particularly meant for producing a ceasefire, what they call a de-escalation. And that's why we believe that Astana does deserve patience and support. But of course, what he's really keen to do is to get the US involved. And RT pointing out that the US is ready to consider no-fly zones if Putin and Trump sort of make any progress. But is this any more than Tillerson giving a different perspective than Trump, or a different fighting a different course than Trump? Or what do you think this is about?
What this is, this statement by Tillerson, generally by the U.S., this is just the U.S. attempting to remain relevant in Syria, and so to sort of impose itself somehow in the process that they've been kind of left out of, which is the Astana process. The United States has been on the sidelines. Meanwhile, Syria, Turkey, Russia, Iran have been driving that agreement, which has been very effective. You contrast that to what's going on in Geneva, which is just a talking shop to try to give some political legitimacy to the Syrian opposition. Somehow they might sort of take over in this parallel universe that sort of the West is continuing to operate in. But the comments by Tillerson is interesting. He said he wanted to ensure, Russia must ensure that no faction in Syria illegitimately retakes or occupies liberated ISIS areas or liberated from other terrorist held areas. So basically, I think he's including the Syrian government in there so they can't retake or occupy their own territory that's been liberated from ISIS. So they're also saying Russia must guarantee that the chemical obligation, that they must prevent chemical weapons attacks. So what they're doing is trying to sort of get Russia sort of cornered here, that they're somehow responsible, because the U.S. cannot dictate facts on the ground. Russia is in control of the situation in Syria. So now the U.S. is putting this sort of moral imperative on Russia's shoulders, and so setting it up for basically another Khan Shihoun incident, which they will point the finger at Russia. That's what it looks like. Everything is kind of pointing to some false flag scenario in the near future that the West, the U.S. and Britain will use to ignite some sort of renewed call for intervention or sort of a game changer in Syria, because they've completely lost all ground in Syria, Mike. So the U.S., I might add, has, well, I don't know if we're getting to that story or not, but 8 bases on the ground in Syria, including 6 air facilities. And so they want to know flies, or they're building airstrips in Kobani and Hasaka and places like this in northeastern Syria. So it's clear the U.S. has got this plan to take control or to enable a Kurdish autonomous region, or I don't know. The only thing I can explain this, Mike, is that the United States is only in Syria to fight ISIS. So the longer ISIS is able to exist there, or jihadists, or extremists and terrorist groups, then the longer the U.S. will be able to exist there. Once the terrorist threat is gone, the U.S. has no business there, even according to their own so-called self-styled mandate. So that's what I see. This is just basically putting off the eventual defeat of ISIS and al-Nusra and other related so-called rebel groups in Syria.
Okay, let's come back to the UK then. And David, a quick advertisement, first of all, for an event on Sunday.
Yes, this is being run by a Fresh Start Foundation, principally. And it's looking at state-sponsored, state-endorsed injustice in Scotland. We have a series of speakers who are fantastic. Some people who have been through horrendous situations and have come out the other side, not only surviving, but able to speak extremely eloquently about what they've suffered and what they've been through. We have Robert Green as the final speaker who will close it down. He'll be speaking on his experiences as well. But we are looking at situations that families have suffered. We are looking at situations where people have been trafficked via the Roman Catholic Church. We've been have been trafficked from children's homes into the prostitution industry. And we're looking at ways where this can be fought, this can be exposed. It's going to be there's going to be a lot of information. So that's the Brayport Centre in Dunblane on Sunday, kicking off from 11 a.m. and finishing around 5:30.
Okay, thanks for that, David. And let's come on to Grenfell Tower then. And you wanted to tear strips off this particular Guardian article. The headline is Grenfell Tower, fireproof cladding specified by architects used only on ground floor. Is this just more nonsense from the mainstream?
It's just more nonsense. What they had was a different cladding in the ground floor, and the reason for that is the aluminium composite material is it's very thin, it's 4 mil, etc., and it's relatively soft and prone to damage. You therefore don't use it in areas like public housing on the ground floor because the vandalism risk, etc., and the general robustness of the product is such that it wouldn't be specified. So they're trying to suggest that the architect, again, there was some sort of suggestion of a calculation or something on behalf of the architect. But what we've been arguing and demonstrating all along is the systemic failure of the whole industry, led by and directed by the regulation aspect of this that led to this disaster happening. And the attempt to pin it on one architect is a bit troubling. You have to remember there's 191 buildings have now failed their ad hoc fire test, fire safety test, because they are tall and they have the same cladding material used. So there's 191 architects who made exactly the same blunder, exactly the same mistake. So if we start to see them going after this one architect, are they going to lock them all up? Are we going to have a new architects-only wing in Wormwood Scrubs? I mean, what's the answer here? The answer is to look at the real issues. And I don't see the Guardian doing an awful lot of that. There's a lot of red herrings being raised by lots of newspapers, but principally the Guardian in this.
Well, area. Let's look at a red herring by the Independent then. Grenfell Tower evacuated twice since deadly blaze, sparking major concerns over possible collapse. It has been standing for a while now, David. Is it going to collapse on its own footprint here?
No, that's unlikely. There has been some sort of monitoring system placed in, which is unusual. That alone indicates that there's some concern over stability. And there was this monitoring system was triggered. Apparently, movement of 5 mil was reported, and 5 millimeters in a structure that size, if assuming it's sway, is not really a great deal. The response was to sound a lot of air horns and evacuate the building. So you can imagine how the people around about living in the houses around about the tower felt about that. The people when I was on site a week ago were asking, is the building safe? And the fact that they're having to ask that is very strange, because one of the first things that a council would do after a serious fire like that would be to have a structural engineer's report on the safety of the building, because they're putting people in, forensic people, firemen, investigators, they're putting all of these members of their staff into that structure. They have to know how safe it is in order to do that. There's a duty of care for their own people, if nothing else. So there must be a structural engineer's report assessing that building. But of course, once again, it's not been made public. The people on the ground in Grenfell have not been told. They're left to guess.
And David, the public inquiry, the judge-led inquiry, the poor old judge seems to be having a hard time.
Well, the poor old judge met the residents of Grenfell, and he came off quite significantly second best. And he was defending his position to say how experienced he is and how noble he is and how honest he is and how dispassionate he's going to be in viewing the facts. And of course, the people of Grenfell were saying, well, that's all very good and well, but that's not the problem. The problem is you went on national television and you said you were going to disappoint us on the terms of reference of this inquiry, and that was before you even spoke to us. How can we have any confidence?
The bad thing was he basically told them they were talking nonsense and they didn't basically understand his words. I thought it was a pretty shocking response from him.
It was, and the response back from the audience was, we'll send you the clip. You know, this is all on video, it's all on the public record, and the people of Grenfell can understand plain English the same as anybody else can. And he quite clearly said he was going to disappoint them and make the inquiry was going to be much narrower than people wanted before having a discussion. That is a problem, and he wouldn't address it. And because he tried to pretend that the objection to him was something else, the meeting, it appeared, went extremely badly for him.
Well, just remind me of his name.
Oh, it's gone.
Okay, don't worry. We'll move.
I don't have it off the top of my head.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
No problem. Right. Now, of course, the government has established an expert panel, which is going around the local area at the moment and looking at various buildings. And the expert panel apparently has recommended further tests on cladding and insulation.
Yes, these further tests are, in fact, the BRE Digesters 134, I think, which is the specialist report on safety in overcladding in high-rise buildings. This was the document that was used to justify, via test, the decision to put the PIR insulation foam into that structure. Now, the PIR is the material that burns with very toxic black smoke and produces hydrogen sulfide, carbon monoxide, hydrogen cyanide and other poisonous gases. So that was the standard and the test that led to that decision is now being rerun. Now, the tests that have been conducted so far are being described as screening tests, and what they are is an adjusted, a changed version of the building control test for class O surfaces to prevent spread of flame. So they're retesting this material with the surface aluminium pulled off and the polyethylene core exposed. So they're failing. So they've changed the test to get a result from the material that matches the result that they saw in the fire to make the test indicate that there's a problem. So having changed the test to get the desired result, they've now got 191 of the desired results. But what does that really say? What does that really tell them? Well, not very much. So they're now going to recreate a more realistic test. Now, to be fair, it's a large panel. It's a large fire that's set in a mock window. And the test is to see if the fire spreads the height of the panel, which is 6.5 meters in from memory an hour. So it's a much more realistic test, a much larger scale test. But this is being done without any reference to the potential problems in the test, without any new thinking in how we're testing these products. And it's been done to achieve what? What are we going to get with this? Are we going to have to evacuate a lot of buildings? Are we going to find some sort of justification? I'm not quite sure where they're going with this. I don't know that they are. I think this is just, well, we've got a test. It tells us something. We've got that one on the shelf. Let's do that.
Yep.
Because we have to do something.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for that, David. Look, we're going to end on an article here. Named person legislation is an assault on families that must be opposed. This, I believe, is written by your good lady wife. So we'll end on this Scottish story because named person, Leslie is saying, has not gone away.
It most certainly hasn't. There was a lot of jubilation from the No to Named Person campaign when the government finally came out and said, well, we're making some changes. But analysis of those changes revealed that we haven't really made much progress. What named person was pure and simple fascism. What we've now got is less well-organized fascism. To give you a couple of examples, the requirement for action on the named person is still well-being, and well-being is still undefined in any legislation. So the named person has to act when the child's well-being, which can be anything, is somehow threatened. That is a ridiculous piece of legislation. And the action of the named person must protect this well-being and must do so by sharing information with lots of other bodies. But the sharing of that information is based on welfare, which is a completely different threshold and means a risk of significant harm. So they have to act to protect well-being, but do so on the basis of information that is not shared on the basis of well-being, but shared on a different basis entirely. It's a shambles, but it's not really any more protection for families from the information being shared with everybody in the state, including those who might mean them ill for whatever reason.
Right. Just very briefly, David, the named person scheme, of course, the government appoints a guardian for every child from conception to the age of 21 or whatever it is. What is the status of it in various parts of Scotland at the moment? Are these guardians still being appointed, even though the legislation isn't actually in place, or has all the appointment of guardians been stopped until this legal issue is resolved?
Nothing's been stopped.
Right.
It's charging ahead. The guardians have been appointed. They're being briefed. They're being trained. There's no indication that the training has changed. There's just a little warning. Oh, you must obey the law when it comes to sharing information, and some of the guidance has disappeared. There was one, the information commissioner was shown in a video in Perth explaining how the new named person legislation lowered, and she went, lowered the threshold for sharing information from welfare to wellbeing. That video's disappeared. There's one or two other bits have been edited out, but there's really no change and it's moving ahead. So what we'll find is the named persons will exist, but there will be greater confusion in their minds, in the minds of the various state bodies that will be providing information to them, and in the minds of parents. And how this will work out, only time will tell, but it's not going to be good. And what parents need to do is organise in order to oppose this fascist legislation, because that's what it is.
Okay, thank you very much, David. Thanks for joining us. Thank you, Patrick, for joining us. And thank you very much to Diljana Getayera. I hope I've pronounced that correctly. Thank you for joining us and for watching. We will be back at the same time on Monday. I hope everybody has a good weekend. In the meantime, 1 p.m. as usual, ukcolumn.org/live. We'll see you then. Thank you. Bye-bye.